You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Saoirse McClory. Saoirse, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
So the way this show starts is with a huge question, just to get a picture of your life. Who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to live by or the things you've done to start the conversation?
Wow. So yeah, what a big question. I love that you just dive in like that. And so who am I? And, you know, so a few things come to mind. Mm-hmm. And the other day, actually, there are a few things that have happened recently that have given me some material for this response.
Sure.
And one is that I was participating recently in an exercise with the Human Services Coalition. One of the questions that we were asked is, to describe ourselves in one word, mm-hmm, which is, sure, a lofty
yes, it's a discipline.
Task.
It's a real discipline.
Yeah, but the word, and it was fairly quick, so didn't have much time to think about it. And the word that came to me for me was curious.
Uh-huh.
And that was sort of curious in and of itself. but it feels right. You know, I'm really curious about people, about life. I feel very engaged, mm-hmm, in life. I'm always, I'm just interested.
Right.
So that's a word that comes to me. And another descriptor over breakfast recently with some friends, we were playing around with ideas of sort of who we were, what our task in life was. And we were coming up with different things and telling stories about ourselves to help us know each other in that, mm-hmm, way. And the thing, a thing that came up for me was living fully in the world. Mm-hmm. The things that I'm passionate about is really being alive in the world.
Right.
Other things people, and my work and my, paid work, volunteer work, sure, kind of reflect that, I think. Other things, I'm originally from Ireland, and hence the name, which people often wonder about.
Right. It's not intuitive in American English how to pronounce it.
No. Yeah. But I'm helped immensely these days by an actress called Saoirse Ronan.
Yes.
And there's another Saoirse in town. There's, yeah, Saoirse Grady, my name sister here. So that's helpful. She's,
sure,
been on shows sort of, with making up little songs about how to pronounce it, etc.
Sure. Sure.
But yeah, it's a Gaelic word. It means freedom.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. And so I've appreciated that in my life. It seems, having a name that means freedom, mm-hmm, is, mm-hmm, has been a good one.
Neat.
Yeah.
Neat. Well, and you brought some music with you.
I did.
So would you like, do you still want to start with A Thousand Beautiful Things?
Sure.
And what, did you want to say anything about it before we play it or after we play it?
I've really loved Annie Lennox for many years since I was young, and it felt like a Sunday morning. It feels like a bit of a hymn to me.
Okay. Here we go.
Every day I write the list of reasons why I still believe they do exist.
A thousand beautiful things.
And even though it's hard to see, the glass is full and not half empty.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Saoirse McClory. So, Saoirse, the question I usually go to next is, what are the some of the experiences or the things you've had to learn to be able to live the life you value now? Where you are now at this moment in time, what did you need to learn to be able to maybe not to succeed fully, but to know that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things that comes to me is an experience that I had in my late 20s with a good friend who became ill with a brain tumor and subsequently was unwell for 5 years and then died at a very young age. And we were very close. And during that time, we had some really beautiful and intense and growing experiences mm-hmm. together. And that was a very transformative experience for me. And one of the outcomes was that I immediately oriented myself to how death informs how we live.
Right.
And also I learned a lot about, or I began to think about, I think it's an ongoing, it's a mm-hmm. never-ending lesson, is how to really be any kind of presence to someone facing their mortality. And we're all facing our mortality, to be honest, but, you know.
Or varying degrees of a directness about facing it.
Yes. And another piece was facing or looking at the fact that, you know, I had a tendency to be a bit of a do-gooder, you know, thinking uh-huh. I could save the world and things like that. And that's exploration around death and dying showed me that I really couldn't help at all, that there was a much bigger picture unfolding. Right. And so it sort of put me in my place a bit, and, uh-huh. and I really value that. And out of that, I became a hospice volunteer and ultimately ended up working locally and at hospice care here for many years. And that experience was one that was transformative to me. It oriented me in a particular way.
Right. So what, with this, I grew up in a town where the average age was about 65 of people, a community. And so death was weekly or monthly, people that I knew. It was because in that, you know, that was a very old place. And my dad died when I was 40, when he was 45 and I was seven. And so death was a common thing.
Yeah.
And what did you notice in your 20s that you hadn't noticed before as you walked through with this friend?
I noticed, well, one, it was the first time that I'd had experience of somebody who was my age and who mm-hmm. I was similar to, so it made it very close to me. And sure. I noticed her isolation and her how it felt to me like, and that she expressed how she felt completely other and different and not shunned isn't the right word, but she was painted differently suddenly, and she felt somewhat excluded.
Right. My guess is that people were unable to engage her. They weren't necessarily actively shunning, but they didn't know what to say.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable. And so I noticed, you know, that was something I noticed. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing I noticed was that she was herself right up until when she died. I mean, she was so much, there was so much life in her, and there was so much richness and insights. And she had there were a lot of stories related to that time. We had some very unusual experiences. But I felt it was an intense learning period. And it was the relatability. Like, we can ever fully put ourselves in anyone's shoes.
No, right.
But it was the closest. It was the first time that I'd come close to kind of this, really experiencing how it might be for her and really wanting to accompany her as best I could.
And was it a surprise to you that she became more of who she was, or at least continued as she was, and up until she died?
I guess it was, given that I mentioned it. I hadn't really thought about it being a surprise, but given that I mentioned
you
that.
You might have expected something to change or whatever. And yeah, I mean, some people have insights, but some people just become more of who they are.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Well, it was many years ago now, too, but I do remember thinking, wow, she's so funny and irreverent and all these things, as if when you faced your mortality, you become kind of angelic and ethereal or something. I don't know what I thought, but surprise.
And that's a little bit of the kind of the
myth.
That's the myth. That's also the idea, can we take you to a better place, the do-gooder kind of thing.
Right.
And we can't. I mean, and what's... one of the lessons that I had to learn in working in hospital and cancer care and all sorts of stuff as a chaplain trainee was that, it's the other person's dying and not mine.
Yeah.
And I really just need to be able to engage wherever they are. And people who are both at peace with it and making peace with it have wicked sense of humor. Often, not all the time, but often it's just a very, very clear, no nonsense. Sometimes, it's been more often the case for me than not. So as you, what was it about, how did that orient you? How did that shape your next choices? You talked about how it made you less of a sense of a do-gooder, began to question that. But how did it help you kind of launch your life? Because in your 20s, you're still, unless you have a terminal illness, you're trying to figure out, where am I going to be down the road? Where am I going next?
Yeah. I think the piece, and this may sound a bit cliched, was just this realization that life is really short. Mm-hmm. So wanting to make choices that felt fulfilling immediately. Never been actually a great sort of future planner in terms of, I didn't have a career mapped out for myself necessarily, that I was on a track and then, let that go and reoriented. And let go of a big dream. It wasn't, it wasn't so much that, but I think this piece about leaning into life more rather than, And that's an ongoing thing. It's not like I've got this down at all, but it's an ongoing question. It's about what's best for the whole, what's best, these questions that arrive, arise. How can I be of, true service? How can I, these questions around how to really be here came to the forefront, as opposed to, imagining what my life should look like and going for that. That became much less interesting.
And it sounds like you took on the awareness that life is short and is to be treasured, not like a person who kind of has to kind of make sure they get their bucket list done.
Right.
Because you didn't really have a bucket list. I mean, that's a reaction sometimes that people have to the life is short, which is extreme. And the other, and the other extreme is kind of denial. But when you can hold it in that kind of gentle way, and you can, as you were saying, look at, what's the overall better thing that can happen here?
Yeah.
That's very powerful.
Yeah.
So were you in Ireland in your 20s, or were you in the U.S. by that point?
I left Ireland when I was 19.
Okay.
So it's been a long time since I've lived there. I met this friend, Bridgie, in Ecuador. So actually, I met her in Colorado. I traveled a lot in my 20s, but we got to know each other in Ecuador, where we lived and worked together. So it wasn't... I came back to the States and... Bridgie was from New Zealand, so she went back to New Zealand. I came here. So I came to Ithaca when I was 29.
Cool. I'm just thinking here a little bit. How have you taken this notion of being of service but not necessarily doing good? How did you learn to discern the difference between those two things?
Right. And I should say it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah. Well, every situation calls for a new discernment.
Yeah.
And we're often wrong or mistaken in some ways.
Yeah. I think maybe the doing good, maybe it's in the words, when we do good, it's maybe what that feels like to me is a bit of an imposition, like imposing
right.
what I think should be happening mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. on something, and having, for me, I had maybe romantic ideas about how things should be, and doing good was I don't know, just a bit sticky, and immature. And to be of service feels to me more open. It's sort of, let's see what's here and what's needed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's more sort of, you know, clear. I think it requires more clear seeing. You know, mm-hmm. if we're truly wanting to serve to the highest good or something, it requires us to see what's actually happening.
Right.
And that can be really hard.
Right. And not only seeing clearly in a messy situation, but also knowing that you may be called to do something that will cause pain or hurt in the short term, that may be better in the long run, and people aren't going to call that good.
Yeah.
But if a person can say, and can say to me, thank you, even though I know I may have caused them pain in some way in this process, or they may have caused me pain and they thank me for hanging in there with them, then I feel like we can get there. But it's more about the thanks, giving thanks in the process than it is about the good. At least that's the way I've moved to it, and the notion, the idea of gratitude.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. I've thought of it less in that way, but that's it. Sure. I can see how you would get there and see about, you know, when something at the end of it that has been difficult, be it difficult conversation, mm-hmm. or as you say, you might engage and it seems a little messy at the time, but you come out the other side and it seems it just, there's a rightness to the outcome.
Right.
And for
mm-hmm. you said you've been thinking about it in a slightly different way. Mm. How have you been thinking about it?
I mean, in that way that...
The rightness?
Yeah, the rightness. If it's just like, oh, that was hard, but it feels right. It feels just like that needed to happen.
Right.
And there's a kind of a clearing out feeling. It's hard to articulate.
Well, it's reminding me of the Shaker hymn that says... to turn will be our delight, till by turning we come round right, and we won't be ashamed in any of this turning, because the turning is what we have to do to find what actually works.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. So it's inviting that engagement and just that kind of that dance, you know, really getting in there.
Yep. And it's for people who live more in the moment than who have plans or ideas or who are, and in some ways are less intellectual about it. More engaged. I found that that the more you try to own things by intellectual comprehension, the less you can apprehend them. Which is another term.
Yeah.
You know, we know things that we apprehend. We kind of embrace whole body, and we know things that we comprehend intellectually, but they work in different ways.
Yeah, yeah, and it's such an invitation. It feels. To do both, you know, to bring it all together and kind of understand things with our hearts, with our minds, with our whole beings, and really bring all the intelligences. It seems like there are many intelligences, and we value maybe just one or two.
Right, or more, and especially in an academic town where it's hard, or we go from one extreme to the other here without finding the balance.
Yeah.
Let's cut to music again. What should we play next?
Okay. Let's see. Well, you named gratitude, which makes me... Well, actually, you know what? Maybe Clannad. I think that was an Irish band, and it's a beautiful piece.
Okay. And it's the theme from Harry's Game. Is that significant?
That was a television show, but it's based in Northern Ireland. It speaks to the troubles in Northern Ireland.
Aha, okay.
Yeah.
Fall, the door, fall, the door, fall.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Saoirse McClory. So, Saoirse, how have you had to change in ways that you would not have anticipated or chosen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what has kind of, how has life made you in some sense?
Such rich questions. So something that comes to me with this question is I've changed in, so we had a, and I say we, so my husband Larry and I the whole bunch of us had an experience a number of years ago, and that has kind of changed my life in many ways. And that was, there were some kind of family trauma things that went down, and we ended up sort of unexpectedly becoming foster parents to a couple of nieces. Mm-hmm. And it was it was a very intense time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a really beautiful experience. Like a lot of good has come out of that for many people involved.
Right, right.
And I, you know, and hard stuff, you know, it's not like it was easy, but it was one of those rich experiences.
Right.
And, you know, a whole village came to bear on, you know, in every kind of camp or quarter to help lift things up.
Right.
And I think one of the ways that it's changed me is have a whole bunch of people in my life who I would not necessarily have grown to know and love as deeply and well as I do, appreciating some systems in place, some mm-hmm. supportive systems and the flaws in those systems, a kind of the humanity of everyone involved, mm-hmm. the kind of leaning into kind of people trying to do their best, even in our, including all of us, in our clumsy ways.
Right, right.
And it's, so what it's done is expanded my capacity for a lot. And it's woken me up to kinds of relationships and ways of being that weren't wholly active in my life before.
Right, right. And the clumsiness is not so frightening.
No, it feels very, it feels very natural. You mm-hmm. know, we all have our stuff and we've got, you know, there's a lot behind every person.
Right.
And there are systems that are just bogged down. And it's just, it just feels like, oh, you know, we're doing our best and this is messy.
Right, 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 right. So how did you, a lot of people aren't anticipating something like this.
No.
And so when it comes into their life, there's kind of a breaking open of what has been a settled or seemingly a settled peace or a relative peace or at least a known life.
Yeah.
How were you ready to respond in this way?
Yeah.
To assume the awkwardness and to take a role in it?
So I think one of the factors that arose was this realization, you know, I'm really seeing my own selfishness in a way that there was the readiness. I saw that my resistance to opening up our home or being involved
sure.
to the degree that we did had a lot to do with preserving a very comfortable little life.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked myself the question, it's like, what am I preserving by not opening up to this?
Mm-hmm.
And I can only speak for me, not for,
sure.
for Larry. But it was around, well, the things I want to be freed up to do are kind of, you know, to make the world a better place, to be doing these things that uplift. And it's just like, what
it's
better opportunity?
Good...
yeah, it's like ridiculous. So I
life
saw
is
the
knocking on your door.
yeah, I saw the ridiculousness of that, and so like, hold on, this is crazy. I want to be freed up to, you know, do this comfortable way of being that I'm satisfied with. And I just saw the selfishness of it. And a question that was really helpful in terms, you asked about readiness, you know, and I think the question for me that was helpful, it's like, what's best for the whole here?
Mm-hmm.
Not what's best for me, not what's best for our marriage, not what's best for any of these individual pieces.
No one view.
No one view. It's like, can I expand and ask myself, what's best for the whole?
Right.
Like, and the whole meaning the future.
Yep.
You know, what? And then it became really obvious what the answer should be. And the readiness was just there.
It became.
It's like, well, of course. And then it became an embrace rather than a kind of, you know, there's something that in my work we talk about, you know, shifting from have to get to.
Right.
It's not that I have to do this. It's like I get to do this. What a privilege that this is landed on our doorstep and we have this opportunity to help, you know, to offer ourselves and be part of this, and we will grow. And we, you know, I've learned and benefited as much, if not more, from anyone in that process. Mm-hmm. So the readiness came from, you know, taking a long look. It wasn't even that long.
No.
It was just like, okay, well, that's ridiculous.
Well, it's not a matter of time in terms of length, but it is a matter of the breadth of one's life.
Right.
And those around you, and to really assess. And we are, as a culture, we're taught to be individual consumers and people maximizing our lives rather than being just seeing the fabric in which we live, seeing the tapestry of our lives and honoring every thread. To the extent that we can.
Yes, nicely. Yeah. But
So you realized it sounds like you realized the absurdity of holding on to something when you were being called to do what you wanted to do in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, and who knows whether wanted to do it in the first place or not, but the call feels true, to use that language.
Right.
And I think that about you know, how that informs me now in terms of reaching in and saying, what is any of our callings? Mm-hmm. You know, because there's so much actual need in the world. There's so many things that we can do. There are so many projects. I remember years ago going to an event and, you know, it's about the Freedom Riders. And a question was, would you get on the bus if this were good? And someone responded, there are so many buses. This idea that there's so many buses that we can get on that need us to get on them. And so it feels like, you know, some discernment. It's like, what is it in ourselves we can trust to feel a calling?
Right. Is this my moment, my bus, my battle, or my hope, or my specific? And there's something that could be mine, but I'm not fully there.
Yeah.
I'm not fully enlivened by it, and I probably ought to leave it to somebody else.
Right. Right.
Rather than to do it in a half-assed sort of way.
And then it begs the question, there's constant tension between when are we also just keeping ourselves comfortable?
That's right.
So when do we need to stretch a bit?
Right.
When do we need to summon up a bit of courage and be uncomfortable and lean into something? So it's an ongoing, you know.
And there's a difference between what happens in our inner life and what happens with the people outside us and those who are most closely to me. My partner has described me both lovingly and with a certain amount of judgment as morbidly flexible. I will try to accommodate or meet just about anything within, but I will oftentimes forget to take care of myself in that process, or come close to, so that, you know, it's the morbid part. and that has been a really important lesson for me. Something can be of value, but I don't have to address it, especially because or I have to find a way to address it that also allows me to thrive, or at least to live.
And
that's a good challenge. That's a really good challenge for me.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think a good challenge for many of us when life, you know, people's lives can be so busy and, you know, so full. And I think realization that's come to me too is that part, for me anyway, living wholeheartedly and fully is actually saying no.
Right.
And that was like, oh, okay. So saying no can actually open up a lot.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Let your no be no and let your yes be yes.
So that
you can give each one in a wholehearted way.
Yes.
And that's I agree. I'm with you on that. How has this how does this experience you said that it's changed your understanding of the context of your community, your personal network of people.
Yeah.
And it's changed your sense of how to lean in going forward. What is that about?
Yeah. So I think, our lives, I think the people around us have changed a bit as a result. Our family here has expanded. Mm-hmm. And there have been other pieces of that too. I mean, Larry and I, for a long time, we didn't have any family members in Ithaca at all. And then in the last few years, we've had quite a few. My sister is here, my stepsister, nieces. For a while, Larry's mum was here. And then the kind of the folks that come along with those folks.
Right,
and
right.
It's very beautiful. So the network has changed. And it's very rich. We learn a lot from each other, I think. I've learned a lot. And love everybody, and so it's changed. And then for me, I think I had another change about having family around, and my brother's been visiting a lot recently too, just very recently in the last year. He loves the music scene here. He lives in Virginia. But up until this point, I actually had left Ireland when I was 19. I traveled a lot. I was very sort of on my own. I didn't actually spend much time with my family. I was sort of very independent. So I feel like I'm learning lessons sort of late in life about the value and beauty of family, being in close relationship to people who are quite different from us, and yet feeling this connection, a deep connection.
And having some early stories that are very common,
early in life, a little bit.
Yeah.
Although and I had my brother and sisters. We went to different boarding schools and things like that.
So
we were separated for a bit longer,
right?
A bit earlier than some families.
Sure. So genuinely is discovering the other to whom you have some really strong feelings and experiences.
And really deep appreciation. Yeah.
So you own your family now in a way that a lot of people don't get a chance to if they haven't been away.
Right, that's true. And even, I have a sister in LA who came, not in LA, where does she live? San Diego. Uh-huh. and she visited not so long ago for the first time since we got married 20 years ago, so that was really great. I mean, I've seen her since in other places, but it feels like there's a rich kind of family deepening that I'm appreciating right now in my life.
Cool.
Yeah.
And how does you work in hospice?
I don't anymore. I left there a number of years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's where I first heard about you. So that's why I'm making that mistake. And you've moved on to.
Yeah, I work for an organization called the Network for Grateful Living.
Yes.
And you may have heard about that through Margaret Wakely.
Yes, I have, and I think through others.
Okay.
So
that's where I work now, and I love that. I work from home, and it feels like in many ways a natural extension from working at Hospice Care. And I serve as the website coordinator. We have a website called gratefulness.org. And yeah.
So I saw your path pretty clearly. I thought taking in relatives in time of need, all of that impact. It's like also taking on a terminal illness
and
welcoming it into your life in a way that allows you to engage it rather than just push it away. And that process of the struggle to do that is what commands so many people's early experience of what may well be a terminal illness. So how did you migrate then to gratefulness.org?
So I had subscribed. They have something called Word for the Day, and it's you can sign up online and receive a quote each day in your mailbox. And so I had been doing that for some time. And during my years at Hospice Care, I think I had used some of their material or been interested in some of their material on grief and gratitude. And so I had a connection with them. And I, around the time I left Hospice Care, I offered to volunteer. and it ended up growing into a job. It was around the time there was a transition happening mm-hmm. there, and I was invited in to help support Margaret. And so it was great. So I fell into that, and it's been really wonderful. And when I first started working there, I thought it would be a temporary, nice little bridge opportunity mm-hmm. and kind of what's not to like about gratefulness. And then since I've been there, the job has grown and become more than a temporary mm-hmm. job. I've been there now over 4 years. Maybe it's almost 5 years. Is that possible? And I've come to really appreciate the richness and the transformative power of gratefulness in a mm-hmm. way that has been a bit of a surprise to me.
Right.
And so, I love it.
Yeah. So what is the surprise? What were you not aware of that you know now?
Yeah. So I think I felt I was experiencing gratitude and gratefulness on a fairly superficial level. Mm-hmm. I thought, yeah, it's good to be grateful. It's good to appreciate what we have. And I think fairly early on, I think there were people that wrote in that this website is frequented by, you know, thousands of people every day from all over the world, and mm-hmm. hearing from people and about how the website really was a lifeline for them. There was a communication from some nuns in Rwanda who were doing work with victims who'd been gang raped and had terrible experiences during the genocide, lost a lot of family mm-hmm. members, and they were working in that environment. And one of them described gratefulness.org as a lifeline, you know, this reminder of goodness.
Right, right.
And a reminder. And I thought, oh my goodness, if you can work in that environment and be finding things to be grateful for and to be fed by that, that's really powerful.
And you can't work in that environment if you don't find right. some things to be fed
yeah.
by.
Yeah. So it kind of oriented me to the depth of possibility there, and I'm feeling, yeah, I just see the way it plays out in our society, this feeling of lack, this hunger that we have, and we consume so much,
and we're so unsatisfied.
We're so unsatisfied. And it's not to say people's lives aren't difficult, but mm-hmm. for many, many of us, the basics are really taken care of, and we can't take it in.
Right.
And there's no ground for us from which to do anything. You know, I find too, when I'm in that place, if I'm in a place of lack and scarcity mm-hmm. and fear, I'm really not much good to any myself or anybody else. You know, I get so small. And when I can experience and tap into and or cultivate a feeling of enoughness and right. this is good, and start noticing the good, and it just becomes, you know, a more natural orientation, then it's there for me when I go through hard times. You know, right. it's almost like when right. we do it, when there really is an abundant life, and certainly I'm an extremely fortunate person. I have a lot of goodness in my life. There's a lot to be grateful for. So I have all of that, and when things get tricky or hard, it's there.
Right.
Yeah.
You're reminding me that I interviewed in my doctoral work, I interviewed people who work in some of the most violent and poorest neighborhoods in Detroit and Chicago mm. and New York. And they talk about moving from fear to trust.
Right.
And to make that transition often requires going through something like gratitude.
Yeah.
Or taking your challenge as a gift from with which you can work. And when you're a non-anxious presence,
yeah.
when you're grateful, you can actually see things to do that you'll be blind to
yeah.
when you're full of fear.
Yeah.
But getting to that level of trust, which doesn't depend on what other people do, it doesn't depend on your circumstances. It depends on your capacity to manage yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, not externals, you know, it's the internal piece. Yeah, and that's beautifully put.
And it makes you see opportunities that others are blind to.
Yes.
Even in themselves.
Right. Yeah. Opportunity. Yeah. Being alert to that and seeing them and having them reveal themselves because you actually can see.
And because it's unassuming, you just see it. People often share it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a little bit what we're doing right now on the show.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Nicely put.
So let's cut to music, and then I want to talk, because this is kind of a really natural segue into self-care. What should we play next?
So I've brought along Sim Redman's Life is Water, and that, yeah, just a great local band. Love their generosity, and it speaks to some of what we've been speaking about. You know, we all need a hand, you know, and
here we go.
Thanks.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Saoirse McClory. So Saoirse, the last segment, the way we close this show out is with people reflecting on self-care. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you take care of yourself emotionally, physically, intellectually, throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, throughout the decades of your life? And how do you know you need to do something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think there's the, I meditate, and that's been a real, I think, grounding practice for me, a bit of a lifesaver, gives me a lot more space.
Sure.
So meditation, I practice yoga, I ride my bike, I like to dance, I like to read, I like to walk in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
I just walk around Fall Creek where we live.
Yep.
So be out in the world. And so I do all of those things. And in terms of how do I know I need to do any of them? They actually feel important sort of all the time.
Right.
So
how do you know to avail yourself of them?
Yeah. So I just... I can really feel how they serve my life. You know, I guess it's going full circle to living life fully. And that feels really a part of, for me, feeling alive and engaged, or to make sure that these kinds of things are happening.
Right.
Otherwise, it can feel off balance. Right. And so that would speak to the when do you know you need it. If things are off balance, is just if I start feeling too much in my head and too small, you know, about my thinking, or super tired, or those kinds of things. Which is, I'm extremely fortunate. I work at home and I have a very flexible job, and so I have, my life right now really allows for me to, the self-care is very naturally woven in.
And over the years of the show, and I've asked this question almost from the beginning, it's been one of the few constants. The first question and the last question have been pretty constant over the years. But about a third of people have a real plan, like a schedule, because they need that to kind of make it happen. And about two-thirds of the people don't. And they don't only not need it, they don't want it. About a third of them, it would really get in the way. And it seems like for you, you might be one of the people for whom it might get in the way. But what does your day look like in terms of do you meditate at a similar time every day? Or do you have a group of people that you sit with? Or
yeah. So I tend to meditate in the mornings. Mm-hmm. And I will often go for a walk in the mornings as well. And so that, and you know, I work at home on a computer, so I make sure I kind of stand up and things like that. Yep. I'll, you know, when the weather is nice, I mean, I walk or ride my bike. I haven't been riding my bike that much this year. I also, every month I do a little home retreat, meditation retreat. So sometimes that will be like a full day is like 7 hours, and it's half day is like 3.5 hours. Mm-hmm. And, so I'll do a little retreat, sort of a focused practice, and that's really, really wonderful as well. But so my day generally involves, even if it's a short practice or and a little bit of yoga, and then I go to a yoga class once a week, wonderful yoga class with Gisela Conrad. And I've just discovered last week, oh no, the week before last, yoga dance at Fine Spirit Studio, 7 a.m. Fridays. And I have only been once, but I thought it was fabulous, so I'm going to go back to that. So dancing is another thing that I enjoy.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. So when in life did you become aware that your job is, part of your job is self-care? And how has that awareness either dawned on you or kind of integrated into your life?
You know, I don't know whether, well, you know, to be honest, I think it may have been when I started working at Hospicare a little bit. I mean, I was in my job previous to that. I would definitely do many of these things. Right, right. I wasn't very conscious, though, of it. I think when I was at Hospicare, when I first started working there in the front office, I used to, during my lunch break, either walk around, they have a beautiful pond up there, and or I would sit, there was a little quiet room, and I would go and meditate there during my lunch hour. And I was very... Looking back, I was quite committed to that, even though it was a busy place and people often, you know, worked through their lunchtime things like that.
And,
I realized
but that
it
kind
was
of
important.
Intensity kind of calls out some. Oftentimes, for me, that kind of intensity means I need to do the opposite,
right?
To create some space for myself.
Yeah, and I, and to me, to be honest, I didn't have a very intense job because I wasn't doing direct care, but I was in that environment. But I also felt that I could just experience that I was more available when I did those things.
Sure.
And so I guess that was a conscious decision then to commit to those practices then. Yeah.
And to be a calm, I mean, it sounds like you're trying to be something of a calm center in the midst of other people working through their lunch hour, doing the crisis stuff or whatever.
Yeah, and I wasn't, I don't think it was either, think about.
Even intentional.
No, I just could feel the difference and thought, oh, well, this is what I should be doing. Yeah. It felt kind of simple. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some people, I've discovered that some people, when they find that, when they look at the roots of their self-care, they find things that they learned as children. You know, 5, 6, 10 years old, or they find, or they have to learn, unlearn things habits that they got into in terms of pushing through or whatever. That's a good skill to have, but sometimes you want to be able to just take care of yourself so you don't push all the time. I'm curious, in going to boarding school, which mm-hmm. is a common experience among certain groups in the world, how did that affect your ability to see yourself as a person who was kind of independent and in need of taking care or directing her life?
Well, it's interesting. I don't, being in a boarding school, it's funny. I've never thought of that being the experience that made me independent. It wasn't so much that I was in the bosom of a family that was very close and then I had to leave
families
them.
That are very close oftentimes don't send their children to boarding school.
Yeah, exactly.
They find them ways to keep them closer.
Right, exactly. Right. So
it was maybe a symptom rather than a symbol rather than a...
Yeah. Yeah, so it didn't feel... It felt less like... The going to boarding school didn't feel so much as independence as actually a real container. It felt very secure and safe because of the rules and the... it was, Benedictine convent, and it was, I loved that. It gave maybe it gave space to be independent because there's freedom that comes out of a container.
I had one other guest who began her description with curiosity, as you did yours.
Yeah.
And she talks about having to have a structure. And the structure allows freedom, which was her word, which is the definition of your name. And in a certain sense, structure is conservative. But it also allows us to engage that which is not like us or beyond us or with which we are unfamiliar or even at odds with.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And once you've experienced structure, you can learn how to replicate it.
Yeah, interesting.
But you were talking about doing these things when you feel them rather than having so much of a plan and following your intuition about what's working.
Yeah.
And that's kind of having internalized a structure.
Yes.
Without having to assert it on others or to overly define it.
Yes.
Which is where I think people trip when they try to define things and then live up to them rather than be just internally aware.
Yeah, exactly. And allow that the guidance or the information to come from internally.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's those are just some of the ways these connections play.
Mm, mm-hmm.
How has working at home has made it easier?
Yes.
For you to follow your internal guide.
Yeah.
And how has it affected your connection to the wider world?
How is working at home? Well, the freedom then to travel. I have wonderful stepchildren who no longer live in this community, and sometimes they visit or we can visit them. So it allows a flexibility to keep in touch. My work is I can travel with it.
Sure.
I can take a laptop.
And as much as you live with it at home, you can take it to the wherever you are.
Yeah. So in that way, I can physically move around a bit more. And we went to Ireland last year, and I can do that. And also, it astounds me. I love people. Extrovert perhaps, but I wondered how it would be working from home and not so much part of the community that had been my experience in my work life before. And one of the things is I realize I'm connected to so many people through this website, and also the team I work with. We connect a lot through various platforms, online work sharing platforms, and that's really rich. Mm-hmm. So I have this different experience of being connected to the wider world. So it's a really wonderful compliment to also then living in a great little town where there's a lot going on. Right. And then this, I feel that I have this connection to a much larger world because I have colleagues all over the place, and that's beautiful.
Saoirse, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Yeah, I feel the same way, Eric. Thank you.
What would you like to close with?
So the next song is by Michael Franti, who's playing next week, next Friday at the State Theatre. And it's Good to Be Alive Today, and it's speaking about how, wouldn't it be extraordinary if everyone could say that? It's good to be alive today. So a good wrap up, perhaps.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a long road. Oh. Every day I wake up and turn my phone on. I read the news of the day just as it's coming down. I do my best not to let it get me down. I try to keep my head up, but this is Babylon. This world's in crisis, we try to fight it. This changing climate, with scientists and with politicians divided by it. So many ways we could solve it, but they will never sign it. This mountain's tumbling down, but still we try to climb it. It's in the Torah, Quran, and in the Bible. Love is the message, but somehow we turn to rivals. It's come to people always picking up their rifles. Another school getting shot up, homicidal. Some people trying to look fly, some people trying to get high. Some people losing their mind, some people trying to get by. And when you look in my eyes, you'll see the sign of the times. We are looking for the same thing. But what if this song was number one? Would it mean that love had won? Would it mean that the world was saved? And no guns are being drawn today. What if everybody had a job and nobody had to break a law? What if everyone could say, yeah, yeah, that it's good to be alive today? When they would hear a siren, like help is on its way, but now they only think of violence. Another youth in the streets and police is in a conflict, and now they hear the guns click. Yo, Ebola crisis and ISIS is taking heads off. A drone is bombing the village and now the kids all signing up to be soldiers, but they are willing now to do the killing now. But are you willing now? Some politicians out there making